Hello and welcome to this episode of Demystified as we explore home cooking in a modern world. I'm Linda and I'm here with my friend Paul. Hey, how are you going?
Hello, Linda.
How are you?
I'm all right.
Another Friday, just like that.
Yeah, it goes pretty quick, actually.
It does go pretty quick. Well, I have a topic and I was going to ask you about, to see what your opinion is about this.
It's always dangerous.
It's always dangerous and sometimes it could be, you know, the world's shortest podcast and be over in less than a minute. But I got a recipe feed on my Facebook pop-up and it was about how to make stroganoff. And I love stroganoff, even though most times I can't eat it because it's got mushrooms in it. But I love it and I'm always looking for that perfect blend of sauce because sometimes they're, you know, anyway, I'm too tomato-y or they're too something. And I, as I said, I can't eat them when I'm out because they always have mushrooms. But this recipe, which intrigued me, didn't have mushrooms, but started off by taking the steak, cubing it, and then whapping a whole lot of mayonnaise over it into the meat, and then putting in the onions and garlic and then throwing in the meat. And I wondered, what would the mayonnaise do for that meat, and would it add anything, or could there be another way of, why mayonnaise? It's just something I've never even thought of putting around meat before I cook it in that kind of dish. I've never seen that before.
I'd need to have a look at the recipe. The only thing I could say is, okay, so here's a test for you.
Oh, no, it was my question to you. Don't throw it back.
What's the bulk of mayonnaise made up of?
Oil?
Yeah. That's a fact.
That was a sigh of phew.
Yeah, so oil. So I have seen people do mayonnaise and then sear and pan fry and do stuff like that. It's essentially it's not another fat, but it's a very high fat content. In the case of stroganoff, I'd have to look at the recipe.
Well, it was pretty simple. It was chopped onion, garlic, put the meat in. Then throw into that when it was browned a little bit. Brown the meat.
And that's the key, right? Yeah. So I think what's happened there is they've used the mayonnaise to help brown the meat quickly.
Okay, because then they just put in three ingredients.
Yeah.
Tomatoes or ketchup.
Yeah.
Mustard.
Yeah.
And then a whole lot of sour cream.
Yeah.
That was it. Very simple. That was the recipe.
It's funny, yesterday I was having a conversation with, I suppose you'd call him a client. Whenever I go and do a function at this particular venue, this guy always comes up to me and hits me with his cooking questions, which is fine. But he's having a problem with his mushroom sauce for his schnitzel, right? He went to Italy and had that somewhere, and he's been trying, and this is years ago, right? He's been trying to mimic it. And so I've tried to provide him with some advice, several different methods and techniques that he can employ to try and make it better. And yesterday I said to him, listen, I need you to tell me exactly what you're putting in this sauce. And so what he's hunting for is probably what all of us are hunting for is flavor, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay,
so he's on the hunt for flavor, but he's essentially using mushrooms and cream.
Okay.
That's it. You know, a little bit of garlic, and he's pan frying his, I think it's a chicken. It's like a chicken pie, so a very thin chicken breast. And he's making a mushroom sauce in the same pan, trying to do it all at the same time. And there's some flooring technique there. But yeah, the first part was that he wasn't getting any color in his mushrooms, but he's expecting the mushrooms to be quite bold in the sauce. Like, you've got to pan fry them and get some color in them. That's how to get some flavor into it. And I'm not a big one for making overcomplicated sauces, but if you add poorly cooked and semi-sauteed mushrooms and cream together, you're not getting much out of it.
I would have thought there was a lot of water content in mushrooms watering it all down again when you add the cream.
They're actually a funny one, mushrooms. Well, yes, they do have a lot of...
To some people, they're funny.
Yes. They do have a lot of water content. They can be a little bit... They can work a little bit like a sponge and draw flavor in as well. So not like an eggplant would. Like, eggplant really is quite spongy, not the vegetable itself, but when you go to cook it, like if you've ever tried to pan fry eggplant in some olive oil, the olive oil just vanishes. Like it just sucks it up. So their mushrooms are a bit weird. Or some mushrooms are a bit weird like that. Doesn't answer your question about your stroganoff, but it just reminded me because I thought, you can add various ingredients to any dish. I would suggest that the mayonnaise thing is to help get color on the exterior faster, because what they're probably not wanting to do is overcook the meat. What do you remember what cut it was?
It was blade steak.
Yeah. You see, because that's a bit of a, how do I say it? It's not a true secondary cut, but it's not a true primary cut. So there's a very fine line between that being palatable and not, depending on how you cook it. So blade steak can be a bit tricky to cook.
Yeah, I normally use blade steak and cook it long and slow.
Yeah.
In a casserole type.
Yeah, yeah.
Braise type.
Whereas Yeah. Whereas like a stroganoff isn't really that, right? You're not cooking it for hours. It's a 10-minute, 15-minute cook, sort of, which is probably a weird time, really, because you're either wanting to cook it really quickly and get it done and serve it sort of rare-ish, or do it low and slow type thing, which is where some of these recipes fall apart. It's not the recipe. Like, I'd be interested to know, like, when stroganoff came about, what the cut was that was used, because I bet it wasn't blade.
No.
But anyway, so yeah, but you can use mayonnaise to help colour the surface of something, but it's the bulk of it is just another fat. And it's a convenient thing too, because you don't have to deal with butter. Oil slides off and mayonnaise is a bit tacky, right? So it'll stick to the surface, so it can help. I've never done it myself. It's never been a thing that I've thought, hey, I'm going to try this and this is going to be really good. I don't know if it has any impact on flavour. I have no idea. I wouldn't have thought so. Like, because when we, and I think we've talked about this, right? When we talked about eggs, one egg yolk when you're making mayonnaise. So when you make mayonnaise, it's egg yolk or whole egg or egg yolk, mustard, generally a little bit of acid, so vinegar or lemon juice, and oil. That's pretty much a mayonnaise recipe. But the funny thing is that a single egg yolk will, once you get the mayonnaise started, right? And considering the fact that you put mustard in it as well, mustard's also an emulsifier. One egg yolk can hold almost an infinite amount of oil.
Wow.
Okay. So you can actually, like, quite often you'll read a recipe that says, do two egg yolks for 500 mils of oil, right? You can actually do one egg yolk and make liters of oil of mayonnaise. Once you get the emulsification started,
okay,
it's almost infinite. Almost. I don't know what the extreme end is. But, yeah, so I would say to you that all they're doing is using the fat, which is the bulk of what mayonnaise is to get some colour.
Okay.
We have a couple of listener questions.
Oh, have we? Okay, because I was going to ask you to – are you a stroganoff fan?
Do you know what? I haven't cooked or eaten a stroganoff since I was a child. I think it was a dish of the 80s.
And you know that's where I'm stuck, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Musically, so, food-wise, you know that's me, right?
Yeah. So I don't like. I think it's something that like Mum used to give us.
Yeah.
I think, and that it was back in those days. The international herb du jour was like paprika. Yes. Because I think you put paprika.
There was a little bit of paprika. Yeah. Yes. Now that you mention it,
because it's Hungarian, right?
I think. But it was a sprinkle.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I'd probably go a bit heavier than that, but that's me.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, okay.
It's Hungarian though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Stroganoff? Yeah, yeah. So I'd like paprika.
Well, I'm not sure. I've never been to Hungary, so
yeah.
I don't know if it's but whether we've called it that.
Like, I might have to cook one, right?
Anytime, but then you probably want to put mushrooms in to make it properly. But,
well, I don't even know if mushrooms is traditional, right?
Neither do I.
Yeah.
But they seem to have, landed very fairly and squarely in the recipe.
Yeah, but that's in Australia.
That's right, like lemon chicken.
Yeah, but like.
Or honey chicken, which I'm not sure the real dishes.
Remember, I distinctly remember very early days being shown how to make a pasta carbonara correctly. And then right throughout my younger years of cooking, if you would go out and eat it, everywhere would be crank.
Yes,
it would often have mushrooms and it would often have spring onions too.
Yes. Yes, I do remember those. Well, I could never eat it when it had mushrooms, but I do remember the spring onions and cream phase.
Yeah.
And I have had it without any of that, really lovely.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's fantastic. Okay, so we've got listener questions. Okay. Yeah,
they emailed them through. Look.
Excellent. Thank you. Excellent. Yes. Great.
So someone was listening to our Spice podcast last week. Now, this isn't necessarily related to Spice, but it sort of is. Someone brought up microplanes.
So
I suggested that a good thing to have in your kitchen kit is a mortar and pestle, but a microplane is also a very good one.
I can back that up. Yes.
Yeah, there are cheap and expensive versions of a microplane. I always find it funny with things like a microplane when the brand name becomes the thing. So all versions of microplanes are now called a microplane because of the brand microplane.
Oh, really? It was a brand first?
Yeah, it's not a – that's the brand.
I thought it was a really simple, clear definition of what that item is. Yeah,
so the brand is microplane.
Well, there you are.
It's like we call – Eskies, but Esky is the brand name.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a cooler.
Or a chili bin, it depends where you're from, right? But we call it Eskies. I always find it. Anyway, so they're cheap ones and they're good ones and they're expensive ones. Do you get what you pay for? Absolutely. So in that scenario, like a microplane isn't an inexpensive piece of equipment, but we were mentioning like whole spices the other day.
Yeah.
So especially nutmeg, really good.
Yeah.
Really, really good.
Totally,
nutmeg.
Yeah.
They're also, like, great for hard cheeses, so parmesan, pecorino, anything like that. Of course, zesting fruit.
Yep, absolutely,
Really, really good. And, yes, you do get what you pay for. And I always tend to get the microplanes that are a bit on the finer side rather than the coarser side because I think the finer ones will do more jobs. A coarse one than trying to do some nutmeg on a coarse or a larger weighted microplane is harder. So invest in a finer one. I think they're anywhere between sort of $20 and $40 Australian.
Yeah.
But if you look after it and it's not the tool to go in the second drawer with the whisk, the wooden spoon, the sushi mat, the rubber spatulas, the ladles.
Don't tell everybody what's in my second drawer.
Yeah, but it's everyone's second drawer. Yeah, right?
That's true.
So they generally do come, a good one will come with a sleeve or a cover. Keep it in that. Yeah. Consider it like a knife, right? So you want to look after it. You also don't want to put it in your second drill. But
no, well, I don't do that.
Now?
I don't do that for a while. So that's, yes, that's a great question.
Number one. So, yes, if you're going to get a microplane, get a good one. Yes. And you'll only need to buy one. And they very, if you buy a good one, I haven't encountered one yet that you want. The only way they'll go blunt is if they end up in the drawer and getting cleaned against other metal. So, yeah. Okay. Second question was around dry herbs. So we didn't mention we were talking spices and stuff like that. So dry herbs like thyme and oregano and rosemary and all those sorts of things. Someone has asked, do we see these in Australia? And is there a big difference in the brands and stuff like that? Okay. So, yes, they are available in Australia. Now, oregano is a different one, right? So if I sort of park that, but if I look at sort of rosemary, thyme, sage, the common hard herbs, what we would term in their dried form, unless you've dried it yourself, but in their dried and then almost sometimes they seem like semi-powdered, but they're kind of crushed down a little bit, they're rubbish. Dried dill, junk. Dried parsley, rubbish. It's got no... I don't find
there's no flavor.
They have any flavor.
No.
And especially, like, you can get a piece of rosemary 5 centimeters long, and that will have a massive impact on your food, depending on how you treat it. But generally, and you can unload a whole little jar of dried rosemary and just not, it doesn't have the same oomph to it. So, while yes, they do exist, I don't use them. Now, I'll put a caveat on that by saying oregano, I do, because actually that works in the reverse. So fresh oregano is very tame as far as a flavor note, and there's lots of different oregano types. So you and I and in your office, we've had several different sort of Greek Cypriot people work here. So they're very specific about
oregano. I was going to mention brand.
Yeah, which oregano they use because it's actually a different variety. And so right throughout Europe, there are different varieties of oregano.
Yes.
But let's say a standard dry oregano actually has quite a lot of pungency and flavor to it, whereas fresh oregano is very tame, very gentle, very mild. So that kind of works in the reverse, that one. So I do in my pantry at home, I don't have dried rosemary, dried thyme, dried herbs as such, but I do have oregano. Absolutely.
And, yes, I have a packet that I have from my from one of those, the lovely Cypriot Penny.
Yeah.
And
it's totally it's different.
Fantastic.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. It is fantastic oregano, I must say.
Yeah. But it's a totally different thing to what you would get out of like a Masterfoods oregano.
Oh, just any other. Yeah. Because it is completely different. And she gets it from a specialty store.
Yeah. And sometimes, so in the car park at the moment, I've got some herbs.
Yes. I did wonder about that.
The greengrocer, I asked him one day for lemon verbena and he didn't know what I was talking about. And then I showed him a picture. He's like, oh, I grow that at home. I've got oodles of it. And so he's obviously got quite a big plant because he said to me, how much do you want? And I said, I just want like a handful worth. Anyway, so he chopped down half the tree and gave it to me.
It's like 3 feet long and about 2 feet wide, that bunch. Yeah.
So it's sometimes good in that scenario. When he gave it to me, I used the fresh leaves on the day, but because I had such an abundance, I have dried it out. Now, I have to actually pick some and I've essentially crushed it and blended it and made a powder out of it, which is quite strong, right? So it's quite good. So you can do it yourself as well. So if you've got really heaps of rosemary, because rosemary's like, over here it's like a weed, right?
Yeah, everyone can grow it.
Heaps of rosemary, you can actually just dry it. So you just break the stalks and hang them upside down in a really well-ventilated area where you get lots of air movement and let it dry out. And then you can make your own rosemary salt and you can do all sorts of things with it, right? So yes, you can throw it in your sauces or stocks or whatever. And I actually think that if you're going to get into dried herbs, you're better off doing it yourself rather than paying for them, because that will be better quality. They'll be stronger, better quality. Anyhow, sorry, I digress. Last question. What's the difference with good French baking tins that are polished stainless steels and cheaper coated grey tins? Do you get what you pay for? Well, okay, so this is a bit tricky because most tins that people are trying to produce today in the baking realms, everyone wants non-stick, right? So it really isn't so much about the surface, it's actually about the material that's been used, right? So while that material might have an impact on what the surface is, but how it conducts heat. Best example I can give you is there's a little French cake called a cannelloni, right? Super easy to make, but it takes time to master. And traditionally, it's probably, how big is that? Like 6 or 8 centimeters tall, probably it's round. And if you haven't ever seen one, just Google it and look it up. They're beautiful, like sort of this chewy custardy cake thing, right? They're only small, little bite, and they're very, very famous. Now, for as long as I can remember, to make them and to make them properly, they had to be made in individual copper molds. And if you go and look online now,
they're not cheap.
Go online and see if you can find proper French cannelloni molds, copper cannelloni molds. If you can find a set of 6 for less than $150 or $200, you are doing really, really well. But of course, now we have silicon.
And I know you're a big silicon fan, aren't
Well,
you?
I do use the silicon, but I use it for very specific purposes. Now, can you bake in silicon? Yes. It's really easy to clean, which is good, but there is drawbacks, right? So those copper cannelloni molds versus a silicon kettle, while on the surface of it would look very, very similar, there is a part of it, and it's kind of like making a paella in not a paella dish versus making it in a paella dish. Mm-hmm. Like you get that, what do they call it? The socorrat at the bottom, right? Yeah. In a paella dish because of the material. It's very thin metal. Yes,
exactly.
Contacts, you know, all that sort of stuff versus not. Right. And you'll still get a little bit of it if you make it in a non-paella dish, but not the same level. Right.
No.
So can you make cannelé, as an example, in silicon? Yes, you can. Will you get the same exact texture, those crispy edge parts, you know, that sort of stuff, if you do it in silicon versus doing it in copper? No, you won't. So my answer to this is a very long-winded answer is yes, you do get what you pay for, but look for something that's going to give you longevity, right? So a cheap springform tin that's on sale at the supermarket, like pick it up, and if you can bend it with your fingers, don't buy it. It's that. It's pretty much that simple. You want something that's reasonably solid. The surface material matters less than what the material actually is constructed of, because different things conduct heat in different ways. The cannelé works because copper is an awesome, awesome conductor of heat.
Great. Yeah.
So
discuss that. Yeah.
Do you get what you pay for? You kind of do. It's also mentioned here that back in the old days, all tins were black, and the it says here the thought is behind that because it would absorb heat better in like gas ovens. I don't know the truth of that, if that has any validity or not, but most baking tins and dishes that you'll get this day have, they could be a variety of different colors, and they could have a variety of different surfaces and even colored surfaces. Like I went and saw some baking tins just before that was gold. They were gold, like not literally gold,
no,
but they were like this non-stick gold color. And I'm like, well, okay, good, but what's it actually made of? So find out what it's made of, see if it's a good conductor of heat, and then you're away.
And so apart from that then,
yeah,
what's purposes do you actually use your silicon molds for, your silicon? I've seen you use them for small individual.
Yeah, so it's really well, for me also because I travel, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
Because I will quite often, if I travel or do a big trip, I carry two suitcases. One is clothing and the other is equipment. Now, I don't want to be lugging heavy baking tins and that sort of stuff around, and because I can roll them, bend them, crush them. Doesn't matter if they get damaged. The only way to damage it is to stick a knife in and cut it. So that's one of the reasons that I have silicon. The other is that it's a convenience thing for me too. I also use silicon molds to, I'd like to use them to set desserts and things like that. So they keep shape pretty well, and then they cool down a lot faster than, let's say, a metal does. So I can go straight from the oven to the fridge to the freezer much quicker. So the mold itself will cool down a lot faster. They're easy to clean. So if you've got a baking tin that's got a surface put onto it, let's say a non-stick surface, as we know with fry pans over time, that's
going to wear off. Yeah.
Right. Whereas this.
And it's not healthy for you, that stuff either.
No. Well, yeah, if anyone's interested, watch a movie called Dark Waters. It's on Netflix. It's actually all about the grand days of Teflon.
Yes.
It's a very interesting movie. But anyway, so yeah, I like them. I like silicon for varying reasons, but I don't use it for everything.
But wouldn't you cook in a silicon?
Well, you've also got to think that silicon's harder to handle when it's hot because the whole thing is flexible, right? So you wouldn't want to do anything too big or heavy. So you don't want to be doing a lasagna dish. Very rarely would I bake a cake in silicon.
Yeah, a cake, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Muffins can be a little bit tricky because you've got to remember you've got to get these things out and you are still moving them while they're potentially pretty hot. So it can be a little bit awkward sometimes. So I tend to things that are lighter, which is why my silicon molds are all individual different shapes and sizes, but they're sort of individual molds. You know, I might have a set of four or six in one silicon piece, but I'm not doing an 18-inch cake in silicon. Because I actually think it's just too hard to manage. And what you'll find is that because it's flexible and if you've got something hot, the likelihood that you'll break it is pretty, pretty high. You're trying to, you read a recipe, it could be any recipe, right? You read a recipe and it says, once it comes out of the oven, turn it out of the tin straight away and place it on a cake wrap to let it cool. Try that with silicon. It's very, you'll break your cakes really, really quick. So sometimes springform tins are absolutely still valid and worthwhile. So, yeah, anything heavy I try and avoid.
That makes sense.
Like you can't, I haven't had any success doing a Yorkshire pudding in silicone.
None, really? Okay. So I know I know you make those,
You know, sometimes you need, because remember, it's not going to hold the heat the way that metal will.
Yeah.
Right? So, and of course, different metals will hold heat better, but silicon will be at the bottom end of that rung. So, it's not going to hold the heat that well. So, if you need something that's going to hold the heat, because remember, as soon as you add volume to anything, it changes temperature. So, yeah, I haven't been able to do, and like I'm picky about my Yorkshire puddings, but I haven't been able to do good Yorkshire puddings in silicon.
So, what do you use instead?
Muffin tin.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the best thing. Yeah, we can talk about Yorkshire puddings all day because it's cool. They're really good to make.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Another topic for another day.
Yes.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you to our listeners for coming in with
some questions.
Some questions.
Keep them coming.
Really appreciate it.
Stops Linda having to think.
Which, as we know, is always a good thing.
All right.
Well,
until
then, happy cooking, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this podcast as we explore home cooking in a modern world. We'd love you to subscribe, and for more information, please go to our website, cookingwithsteam.com.